Hello, I'm John Kelly, and this is a podcast of Mystery Train. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than in the original programme. Mystery Train hits the rails Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on RTE Lyric FM. A song called Edges, and it comes from Innie Kay, and I'm delighted to say that Innie Kay is my guest tonight on Mystery Train. She'll be picking all the music. Good to have you here, Ethna.
Thanks a million, John.
So Ethna's the name, right? And we need to clarify all this first of all. You go by the stage name of Innie Kay.
Yeah, and sometimes people do call me Innie. In Germany I'm known as Innie, so I go by that as well.
But your actual name is Ethna what?
Ethna Nicahan.
Okay, from Kildare.
Yeah, from Cork, County Kildare, yeah.
Kildare, okay. And were you always Ethna Nicahan, or were you Ethna Cain, or what?
I fought quite a lot to be Ethna Nicahan all the way through, yeah. Every teacher in school wanted to call me Ethna Cain, and for some reason I just didn't relate to that at all, so I always said, it's Nicahan.
So you took the Irish name on yourself, did you?
Yeah, that felt like me, you know, didn't feel right.
And did your family use the Irish name?
Yeah, right, okay. We spoke a lot of Irish growing up, so... Yeah, that was my name, you know. So I was like, why are you trying to call me something else?
Okay, so musical background, Ethna, what was it in the house?
I suppose it came through mainly traditional music background, yeah, and lots of actual playing, not so much listening growing up. Bits and pieces here and there, all right, but I was thinking about it more as I was playing a lot and singing a lot growing up, be it festivals or families getting together or, you know, all kinds of occasions and that.
But, was this a natural situation in the household, or was it through school that this was happening, if you know what I mean? Some families learn Irish music, or learn traditional music in particular, through, you know, the school system and the fish and going to doing competitions and so on. And then other families, the really lucky ones, it's actually in the house.
Yeah, I was lucky. My grandfather was a fiddle player. Right. He was known for his slow air playing, my mother's father. And he taught us when we were quite young. So I learned fiddle when I was four from him, a little quarter-size fiddle. So it was mainly in the family and being brought to lessons every week, and also some classical piano. But also in school, I felt very encouraged in the school I went to. They did sort of kind of make sure I was picked out for a few things, for say communion solos and stuff like that, right, and the choir and all that. So I feel quite lucky, because I know so many people say, oh, they weren't encouraged at school. I think when you're encouraged quite young, you feel like you can sing, and it's no bother, you know. So
now your first musical choice is As Trad As It Gets, some Shannon singing from it. Joe Haney, or Joseph O'Haney.
Yes.
When did you first hear Shannon singing?
I was about 10 or 11, and it was at home. We had this record from Gaelin, Joseph O'Haney. It was just called simply Joseph O'Haney, Joe Haney. And I somehow got fascinated by it. I don't really know why, but I just really listened to this record over and over again.
Now, what did you make of it at the age of 10?
I loved the turns of phrases, I think. I think just something really true and gravelly in his voice as well, I was drawn to.
Because even with good Irish, it can be hard to follow the old Shannon singing sometimes.
Yeah.
When I hear someone like Liam O'Wenley, who you know and have worked with, I hear Liam singing sometimes, and the Irish that he's singing is so old and so archaic in some cases.
Yeah, exactly. And the songs are so rich with Irish that we don't sometimes even use anymore. So some of the phrases would be, so rich that way. I can't even say what it was, John. I just was kind of fascinated by it and listened to it at home. We had a record player, just a couple of records, a funny collection really, but this one and Scarra Bray as well, Mairead and Trina Ní Gonal, seemed to stand out for me. So Eleanor na Rún is the one that I subsequently learned and have sung quite a bit. But yeah, I loved his phrasing in this.
Okay, Joe Haney, Joseph O'Haney.
Mara or Naro.
Joseph O'Haney, Joe Haney there, the first choice of Innie Kay, Ethna, who's with me in studio picking all the tracks tonight. Well, that's an auspicious start. You're not messing.
The serious young girl.
When you start the show with Joe Heaney, you know, that's, you mean business. And that was Eleanor Naroon from Joe Heaney. So you were listening to Shannos at the age of 10, and you were playing. Did you keep the fiddle going? You started learning at four. Were you still?
Yeah, very still? Much. Fiddle was my main instrument, yeah. And still is to some extent. Yeah. I could play a lot of fiddle still. All throughout.
And, you know, I'm thinking, well, maybe 10's a bit young, but when you move on, say you get to 13, 12, 13, 14, and the kids in your class are listening to whatever was the pop music at the time, did you go along with that?
The pop music, yeah. I'd be sort of hanging in there to some extent. Like, I'd just hear what would be talked about in the yard, or, you know, what would be on the way to the skating ring or something would be on the CD player in my friend's car or something like
that. When you say hanging in there, that sounds like a sort of, you were just affecting a certain interest in it.
I never felt like I really knew what was going on. I always felt like I had this other side of music that no one else knew about. And that was simply just from like traveling around the country and having certain, having a group of friends outside of school, which were more my kind of people, if you like, my social group. Certainly more in secondary school, I don't think many people even knew I played, you know. It was more my own kind of private social life outside of school.
And did secondary school not sort of swoop you up as an available musician to perform at everything from mass to concerts?
I think there was one or two, maybe the graduation I did something with two others, but not really. It wasn't really, like, we just had music one class a week or something. No, sure, I studied music. It was more than that, but it didn't seem like a big part of school. Yeah,
but your musical interests were separate from your schoolmates. It was a separate thing.
Yeah, I mean, R.E.M. and the likes of the Eels was the first concert I went to, but that was more through my brothers. School was more a lot of grunge and Nirvana and all sorts of stuff like that. That I'd sort of know, but couldn't say I was very knowledgeable on.
Yeah. Now your next choice is Anne Briggs. So tell me about her very influential English, from Nottingham, I think she was from, English folk singer who, you know, wasn't all that comfortable with being famous or pushing herself forward at all, and yet hugely influential on people that came after her, like, you know, and were her contemporaries, like Bertie Ansch and people like that.
Yeah, a lot of people reference her, all right. I just came across her out of the blue. I was down in County Clare recording my first album, which was a more traditional album. Back in 2004 or 5, I was down there with my friend Cuivin O'Reilly, and he had Anne Briggs on in the next room. And I just thought, like, wow, that sounds really familiar somehow or other. I felt I really related to her singing, something in my voice I recognised, or something similar. And I hadn't really heard singing like that before, with a bit of accompaniment behind, female anyway. Like, I would probably get to Paul, Andy Irvine and Paul Brady and that, but not so many female.
Well, she would have worked with Andy.
She worked
with Sweeney's Men.
Yes, yeah, Johnny Moynihan.
Johnny Moynihan, yeah.
But I remember this little descending line in this song, Willie O'Winsbury, which was just so beautiful. And I only, you know, when you're in the next room, you don't really hear fully a song, but I just heard this kind of repeating descending line, and I thought it was so beautiful. And I was kind of, as I say, getting ready to record my own album, so it was a big influence on me at that time.
So this is Willie O'Winsbury, which I assume is an English song by the sound of it.
Yeah, well, I'd say maybe Scottish references there, yeah.
All right, here we go. Anne Briggs. And that's Anne Briggs and a song called Willie O'Winsbury. And this is Mystery Train, RTE Lyric FM, the Sunday night special where we get someone to pick the music. And tonight it's Innie Kay, Ethna O'Cahan. Well, tonight is Ethna, on stage is Innie Kay. We have to keep doing this. So you're in Kildare, and when do you think musically that you may have got some kind of purchase on something of your own, do you think?
Took a few years to figure that out. I think I enjoyed singing so much when I was put in front of a crowd around like early 20s, say. My first proper gig was supporting Luca Bloom and Whelans to a full house. So it was quite a first baptism of fire, you know. And I just enjoyed it so much, got such a great reaction from the audience, and just it felt like what I kind of needed and wanted to do. So it was then a question of finding out, well, how could I get an act together or a set together that would work? And then, yeah, then the journey sort of began as to what I wanted to present and what I wanted to spend my life doing, basically, because you're making the music is your days, or, you know, that's how you spend your days. So what kind and what, why, like what kind of message and do I want to get out, or musically, what I want to present.
Now, when you say you say you enjoyed singing.
Yeah.
In front of an audience. Tell me a bit more about that, because you don't, first of all, you don't strike me as a kind of a narcissist or, you know, someone who's desperate for attention or, mm-hmm. you know, anything like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, just tell me a little bit more about that sense of enjoyment you were getting. Is that, I mean, you know, some singers might, or some performers will say the only place they're really happy is when they're on the stage.
I've heard that, yeah. And certainly I identify, there's a certain kind of happiness that I'd feel on stage that is really different from elsewhere. I think the biggest thing is, God, sort of hard to describe. I'll give it a go. It's that connection with an entire room of people that you wouldn't have if you were going around having a chat with each person individually. You know, it's something that everyone is actually there experiencing together. I suppose close to some kind of meditative experience or
it's a communion kind of a situation, isn't it?
Yeah. And you come away just feeling really enriched and sort of understood. Maybe I'd feel understood when I'm singing in a way that I wouldn't if I was chatting to somebody, or just the voice carries so much. And then people tell you how it impacted them or how they enjoyed it or how it made them feel, and you just feel like you've done something that's of value, I suppose. And I was always seeking something to do, like, since I was quite young, really just something that would heal or something. I was always quite driven. I didn't know what it was I wanted to do. So I think singing just really felt good to me, and then it seemed to work for others as well.
Did you ever want to do anything else? I mean, did you ever train to do anything else or study to do anything else?
I didn't know for a long time. I was quite late and still kind of figuring out. I was quite late figuring out what I wanted to do. But I did an arts degree in university, and I suppose teaching was kind of an obvious choice. Both my parents were teachers, and I had the Irish and quite artistic, and you know, so there was sort of a drive that way. But my father was also a guidance counsellor, and it was quite funny. He didn't really know what to do with me, I think, because I didn't know what I wanted. And so there wasn't really anything else. I did do some alternative medicine for a year, some reflexology and things. So there was sort of a healing instinct there. And I've since trained as an Alexander Technique teacher. So that's kind of interesting as well. I hope to do more of that in the future. But music just sort of naturally, gathered momentum in 22, 23, and kind of went from there.
Okay. Your next choice is, you mentioned him earlier, is a friend of yours, Caoimhín O'Riola.
Yeah, Caoimhín was really an influential friend, and still is. Like, he's one of those people who just goes and finds what he wants to do, and is terribly wonderfully inspirational in that way. He kind of just went and played with Tony McMahon because he wanted to play with Tony McMahon, you know, and the rest of us were kind of going, whoa, Caoimhín. You know, he's just great like that, just going and doing what he wants to do.
People will know Caoimhín from The Gloaming in particular. But when he plays on his own, or he plays with Dan Truman, or he plays, you know, what he does is, it's very hard to describe what he's at. There's nobody else like him. He's a genius, isn't he?
Yeah, I think he is. Yeah, I just recently heard him down in the Quiet Lights Festival in Cork the other weekend, and solo, to hear him solo was great again, because he hasn't been playing so much solo recently. And it was dreamland, like we just were brought off. And certainly not for everyone, but I think for those who it is for, really benefit, it's beautiful.
And in what context do we have him here on what you've chosen?
So yeah, I've known Caoimhín since I was about 10, and I've seen him play with lots of people. But I loved the way himself and Mick O'Brien play together, and their album, what was it called? Deadly Buzz, I think. And it's from that. So it's Dennis Murphy's Fling and two others. The third tune is actually the theme tune for Raja na Gaeltachta, which used to go dung, 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 dung. So I love that one.
There we go. Quívan O'Riola there, and Mick O'Brien, music chosen by Innie Kay, who's with me in studio. You know, when you listen to that, you know, you realise the kind of just the riches we have here. Mm-hmm. And of course, there are similar riches in other countries. But the great thing is now that I think people are becoming more aware of what there is and being less, what's the word? They don't compartmentalise music quite so much. You know, that if you're into traditional Irish music, for instance, you would never listen to music from West Africa or something, when in fact, you know, you probably should be. You know, there are great connections between them. Sonically, anyway, there's connections between the music.
Yeah, I think people are really turning to look at what we have ourselves a lot more recently. I feel that in the last couple of years more so. For whatever reason, probably just groups like the Gloaming and Lancome and different groups of that, are maybe more accessible to people and aren't completely just the tunes. So people who don't necessarily like just the reels and jigs can see that there are elements within the music that they can relate to and enjoy and feel like it is our music.
Because it has to be presented in a way, doesn't it, for it to kind of go beyond a small audience. You know, there has to be a way to represent the music. And looking back, they all did it. I mean, the Kilturi Coolin and the Chieftains and so on put it in a concert hall in a formal setting and so on. The Bothy Band, they were a rock band, you know.
Yeah.
The Gloaming is, you know, they're all, Lancome is a completely different thing again.
Yeah, I think if you try and put a session essentially on stage, it's not really going to have the same joy or beauty that a session has, you know. And it's not saying that a session is, or just tunes are any less or anything. It's just, it doesn't quite work the same on stage when people are just purely listening, like a session, and music and tunes are for dancing, and people get caught up in the unity of all that happening together. But if people are sitting there listening, it's not the same thing. So it does need to change. Yeah.
And what about that idea then of the music traveling in a global way? I mean, it always did, but to this day you get a group like the Gloaming, who when they perform at a festival or an event outside of Ireland, I'm not necessarily sure people are thinking they're at some traditional Irish music thing.
Yeah,
they're just
and I
at
love
some
that.
Extraordinary musical thing happening up there, and nobody's, you know, the people in Sweden might necessarily be, you know, expert in Irish music.
I think it's so refreshing because it's so different from, say, an Irish band going to America and people knowing it was like Kamali songs, and it's very compartmentalised, and that makes it that sort of plastic Irish sort of thing that we've had for so long and are trying to shed. But I think that sort of thing of not knowing what you're listening to is so exciting, because people then have a sort of a backdoor in, or some way, a change of an angle on it all.
Because sometimes when you watch the Gloaming, you know, Martin might be the only one who's playing a traditional tune up there at that particular moment.
Yeah.
Queeving's beside him, but he could be playing anything.
Yeah.
Thomas could be playing something straight out of a Bill Evans record. But yet it all makes perfect sense.
Yeah, because they can, I suppose, when you know your own music so much, or what you're playing, say, be it a tune in the Gloaming setting, or then you can go off like and not be too afraid. You can come back, you know, but you can go way off as well.
What was your favourite trad band when you were growing up? Hmm. Or did you have one? I mean, maybe you were lucky enough to hear enough tunes outside of that more commercial space, I guess.
I didn't really go for bands so much, really.
Yeah.
It was only later I kind of discovered the Bothy Band and how cool they were. And then with Ray, with the band I'm in, like we definitely take inspiration from the Bothy Band. And
now, Ray involves a few people we would know. Tell me who's in Ray.
Liam O'Mahony kind of gave us a call a few years ago. Myself, Cormac Begley, and Matthew Ocasida, and Peter O'Toole, his fellow Hothouse Flower band members. So there's five of us that travelled for 3 years with a show called Rian with contemporary dancers. And then out of that came the band Ray. So we do like maybe a gig a year.
Sounds good.
We're not terribly busy.
Kind of hard to organise those fellas sometimes.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So your next your next musical choice. You're still with the trad now. You're sticking. You're well. It's we're
Well, we
we're
could
moving,
jump.
Well, we're, no. Well, we're moving into the sort of folk rock territory here.
Yeah.
With Sandy Denny.
Yeah, Sandy was, I suppose, a bit like Annie Briggs in that she allowed me to think, I suppose, to take a step out of the traditional world and merge it with something else altogether. And hearing the accompaniment with Fairport Convention and all that, and the song "Who Knows Where the Time Goes" was just such a big influence on me. I think I listened to it all the way from Dublin to Galway on a train one day.
You don't know where you heard it by any chance, because I think, if I'm right, a few other people have actually picked this song as one of their favourites. And it did kind of cross over. A lot of people would know this song who wouldn't necessarily think they were Fairport Convention fans or Sandy Denny fans.
Yeah.
Do you know where you heard it first, or how you came across it?
I was given a CD. I think it was Barry Moore, I think it was Luca Bloom, gave me this CD and said, "You might like this." And I listened to it on the train, and it was one of those moments where I was going, "Whoa, that's so exciting." And I think just the sentiment of the song, it's sort of one of those songs that has kind of the entire whatever in it. There's something very whole about it.
Okay, Sandy Denny. The voice of Sandy Denny there, and the guitar of Richard Thompson, Who Knows Where the Time Goes, the choice of Innie Kay, who's with me in studio. So you definitely, you know, this brings you well up into your teens.
And further. 20s, I'd say, early 20s.
Devoted folky.
Well, here and there, just a few songs that stood out to me, you know. I wasn't listening to loads, but just the ones that hit home were strong, like, yeah.
and was other music having any effect on you at all? Anything, you know, all the other things that were going on in the world musically?
Yes, there were. I was listening to quite a lot. Like, I had this little song book that I just wrote down songs from lots of different genres, just any songs that spoke to me, you know. So there was, in that book, quite a mix. Quite a lot of folky ones, like the Paul Brady, Andy Irvine, Streets of Derry, and Nina Simone, Ain't Got No Life, and Birds Flying High, and Joni Mitchell, and there's quite a range of stuff. But I suppose roughly in the folk, but to me that was like totally different from folk or traditional.
Sure.
That was like completely different.
So were you the kind of person then that was, you'd go for a song rather than for a particular figure? I mean, friends, I know I did, and I think a lot of boys do. You join a gang musically. So if you get into Dylan, you get into Dylan big time, to the exclusion of everything else for as long as it takes to acclimatise the whole Dylan thing.
Yeah.
Or whatever it is. You seem to be, you don't particularly care who, what, where and when.
As long as
the song appeals to you.
A song, like I loved listening to, Beth Orton. I went through a phase of listening to her a lot as well. And then like Dennis Murphy, Julia Clifford, Star Above the Garter, that was an album. So a lot of Kerry music, I was kind of devoted to that. And East Clare fiddlers as well. And pretty specific, but yeah, just bits and pieces of different things, you know.
And we still, where were you living at this point? Were you still at
home? In Kildare, home.
Yeah.
I was kind of moved into Dublin when I was 22, so I was in Rathmines there. And then I think I met Liam O'Malley around that time, and another few friends that just were kind of introducing me to other types of music and seeing what was going on then in Dublin more. And like I remember going to gigs in Whelan's and hearing the likes of Cathal Kinnaigh and that, and just going, whoa, you know, that voice. And then the sort of singer-songwriter kind of what could be portrayed through singing songs like that then became really interesting to me.
When did you write your first song then?
On that train journey listening to Sandy Denny. I wrote my first song, which was called Gui, which is a prayer. It's in Irish.
And you wrote your first song in Irish?
Yeah, I did, yeah. So I write in Irish as well as English, but mostly in English, but sometimes it just comes out in Irish.
So you weren't expecting to have a number one hit with it?
I wasn't. I wasn't going for a commercial success.
Very good. And
Raja Nagoyal would play it a lot, though.
Yes. And then when you started writing, did you find that the floodgates opened? Did you start to write a lot? Or was that sort of a one-off for a long time?
Very... I write a lot, but it's a lot more like journal and stuff, you know, just getting stuff out of the system. But I don't, the songs come very sporadically, you know. I now write a few hours every day, but I tend to write, what I write tends to become a song. There's not a whole lot thrown in the bin, like, mm-hmm. but there's quite a few, quite sparse, but right. they all seem to become something, yeah.
And how long did it take before you reckoned, this is now, maybe the first one you wrote was a great song, but how long did it take for you to think, I'm kind of onto something here, I can do this?
Maybe
you still don't think that.
Maybe that's why the hesitation. No, I think I felt personally like, you know, an excitement and that I was onto something. Even with the first one, or maybe actually I know when it was. I wrote a song called What's in the Bag, Love, and I'm going to re-record it for my next album, but I released it in this 2006 album, which is, as I say, more traditional fiddle and Shano singing, and then two of my own songs, so I was just beginning to write. But I remember playing What's in the Bag, Love to a crowd who's at a party back in my place. I was living in Harold's Cross at the time, and I remember just turning around after it and like bursting into tears because I'd just really released something, and they were all kind of going, whoa. And there was a definite reaction from them that I got a bit of a shock, that I suppose something I'd been working on myself privately, and then sharing it to a group of people and having that sort of silence afterwards, you know, was a bit scary, but also kind of told me that there was something to it, you know.
When you release an album or a song, do you, you know, when you say you're working on one now, does that vulnerability that comes with it, does that concern you? Does it put you off at all? Some people don't like that, and they don't like it to the extent they'd rather not do it at all, you know?
Yeah, I don't like it, but it doesn't put me off.
Mm.
I do think it's necessary. I think... because I suppose the kind of writing I do is really exploring ideas or questions about the world and how things are. And just like to actually get into what I want to say, you have to go through, it's sort of raw emotions and that sometimes. And then, but then when you come out the other side, it's so fulfilling. So I guess... it's really, I've known from the process that it's really worth doing. So I don't mind. Yeah.
Your next choice is Nina Simone.
Mm-hmm.
I Ain't Got No. Tell me about why you like Nina Simone. She really was a one-off.
Yeah, I think she was so different to other people I was listening to in my early 20s. Say, it was definitely not folk. But I was always into, I was always into African music as well. We had Ladysmith, Ladysmith Black Mambazo at home, one of the records at home. And like some of the rhythms there, I've probably heard in Nina's like band. And I mean, broadly speaking, completely different as well. But, you know, I was just very attracted to African music and African-American music. And she just, was so groovy and so strong in the way she sung that I just couldn't help but listen. So I love this one. Yeah, this is Ain't Got No Life.
That should be good.
That's groovy.
Groovy. I was going to say, you used the word groovy earlier, and it's the first time I've heard groovy. It in a long time. So thank you for reintroducing the word groovy twice into the program. Nina Simone, quite something. The choice of Innie Kay, who's with me in studio tonight. Innie's picking all the music. We'll have our next choice after this break. We'll be right back. Anyway, there we are. We're talking about something and we cannot possibly go on air with it. This is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM. Innie Kay's with me in studio, picking all the music tonight. We just had Joni Mitchell before the break and Kerry. We're going back to one of the big folk albums, Andy Irvine and Paul Brady.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that remains to this day like one of the great albums of any sort, if you ask me. And Andy's been on here, and we've talked about that. And of course, they got together again to play this music, which is just astonishing.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. I think it's just when you hear the introduction to this one, and As I Roved Out, I think they're just two just beautiful, the kind of songs that you just go, you know, just sit back and listen and enjoy. It's that hurdy-gurdy sound and the bouzouki together, and then...
Did you get this album when you heard it first? I mean, did you understand what was going on exactly?
Did I get it?
Everything about it, the accompaniment is strange, and if it's your first time out, the sound of Paul's voice, the sound of Andy's voice is strange as well, if it's your first time.
I think, the sound of Andy's voice is a bit strange and kind of peculiar. I'm not sure.
Well, let me explain. I mean, if you're brought up listening to Top of the Pops, mm-hmm. this would have sounded very, very kind of odd in a great way.
Yeah, and of course I was coming from, like, I suppose, unaccompanied singing tradition, and then hearing this cool, like, hurdy-gurdy in the background and going, and then a bouzouki and sometimes two voices together, it's just Andy in this one. And it just seemed like a really cool progression for me, I think, when I heard it. And again, I often go for lyrics in the first line of the song. It's a peculiar song, The Streets of Derry, I think, because it starts off with, oh, after the morning there comes an evening, and after the evening another day. And then it goes into this other, the first line doesn't really connect with the rest of the song. But I love that first line. It's
There's
so
nothing more to
promising.
Say after that, anyway. Yeah. Okay, here comes Streets of Derry, Andy Irvine, Paul Brady. Music there from Andy Irvine and Paul Brady. The choice of Innie Kay, the song Streets of Derry. Sounds extraordinary, that still, doesn't it?
Still, every
amazing.
Time. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So, where did we get with your life and musical career? When did you first go on the road? We're talking about Andy Irvine there, always on the road. When did you first go and start playing gigs?
There's the odd gig here and there for a while, just not really touring or that. I suppose I remember the first time I went off was with a band. I was in Germany, actually, for a kind of 19 tour date around Germany every single night. And I thought, wow, this is not the way to do it. But it was sort of organised, and, you know, you're part of other acts. But 19 nights in a row, it was grueling on a bus. Stopping off at roadside places and eating and motels. And I was like, oh, I don't know if this is this is the way I want to do it. So
that's attractive for about an hour and a half.
But I suppose you do those things and you learn how you want to do it yourself, and you try and...
You mentioned earlier that your dad was a career guidance counsellor, right? Was there ever anything said?
About music and about...
Well, about you having a career in music.
I mean, yeah, to this day, I'm so actually grateful. My father passed away 7 years ago now, but one of my favourite memories is when I went to live in Dingle I went to live there for 3 years to play and write, and I just thought it'd be a good place for me to be. And it was a wonderful time. But I remember when I went down, he said, follow your dream. He said, follow your dream. Here's €3,000 and sort yourself out. Like, have a little contingency, you know, bank account, and have your current account. And we went through a little budgeting thing, and he said, follow your dream. And I say that because I'm so glad to have that memory, because other times there was a lot of they were both quite scared, I think, or not scared, but worried.
Of course. Yeah. Well, you would
so
be.
You would be. And now I see, like, for very good reasons. But I always feel like, at the time when you're in your early 20s or late teens and you're trying and you need that support, sometimes you're not going to get it until you actually make it. But when you need it is when you haven't got it made yet, you know. But then when you make it and you're all confident, then everyone believes in you, you know. But I suppose that's just the way it is, you know. You have to go out and make it work.
That was very, very, what's the word? Far-sighted of him and noble of him and all those
it's
things.
It's one of those,
you know,
things I can hold on to and go, like, you know, when someone has a bit of belief in you, it goes a long way, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did it put any pressure on you, though?
No, because he also said, and if it doesn't work out in 2 years, you know, you're going to have to try something else. And I still say to him, well, it's kind of working out. I'm quite like, you know, it's not like I have everything I need at the moment. Well, I do have everything I need, but it takes a while to get.
And how did Dingle work out then as a place to find yourself or find out what you were good at or begin your creative journey?
I was quite far on, to be honest, at that stage in terms of I was already sort of devoted to music being my life, but it was also I also needed to teach some, and I was doing some translation from English to Irish, and Dingle was a good place to play gigs or you know, so I thought it was good, but it was more really traditional gigs, and I really wanted to do something else. I still didn't really know what, but it wasn't just pure traditional. So there's loads of music and artists living down there, and with the language, and just some great people living down there that I got a lot out of my time there artistically and personally. And that
you could also get distracted in Dingle very easily.
You could. It could go either way in places like that. I think you can sort of forget that you need to have a bit of momentum going. But then there's people like Philip King and other people living down there that you kind of go, God, they're great. Like, you know, just powerful energy, you know, and you have to really fend for yourself and make things happen, I suppose, when you're living in a place like that. Or you could easily kind of just go on the dole as well and, you know, just do the odd thing here and there. But I was quite motivated and really wanted to get myself together. So I put together a music plan. I went into Tralee County Council and got back to work enterprise allowance. And sorry, maybe I shouldn't mention all this. I think this is probably too much.
This is useful information for anybody else who wants to go to Dingle and find themselves.
Or anywhere.
My concern would be I could go to Dingle and lose myself very quickly.
How would you lose yourself?
Well, you know, there's a lot of attractive public houses in Dingle.
Yes.
On either side of the street.
Currens there would have
facing each other.
Yeah, go down to Currens and James still gives me a fiddle from behind. Like, and he could be, I can't leave that place until 5 o'clock in the morning. Like, with the whiskies, he just keeps you feeding you. And
quite apart from that, you could go up and sit on a rock for half a day, you know, and do nothing.
Yeah, I loved it in that I love swimming in the sea. So I'd get up and I'd go for a run, dip into the sea and go home and write for 2 or 3 hours. And it just was a really, really nice time creatively like that.
See, that's great when you, because, you know, you don't need a lot of money, actually, you know.
No.
Unless if you've got a family and so on, you've got, you know, all that stuff, that's different. Mm. But if you're on your own and you're in Dingle, I mean, how much money really do you need? As long as you can pay your rent and get by.
Get the food and that. But then you realise you want a bit more. You want to, you know, I suppose, up the ante a little. And then Rian, the show, came along. And then I was travelling for 3 years kind of with that on and off. So a lot, like, we were literally everywhere.
And then you're a professional musician at that point.
And then, then things like tax and all the rest of it comes in, and you have to manage yourself a bit more.
Still, professional musician, you know, you had achieved what you set out. Well, I don't know if you set out to be a professional musician, but there was no denying at that point you were a musician, a fully functioning, working musician.
Yeah, that's verifying, I think, then when you can actually, I suppose for years you're sort of saying you're a musician and not quite believing it yourself, and people don't really believe it from you either. So there's always tentativeness kind of. And when you're going to get a job and all that, but then when you can actually say a musician and mean it, and it's you have a different relationship to how you describe yourself like that,
which is important.
Oh yeah.
Your next musical choice is what? Broken Things.
Oh yeah, this song is so beautiful. So around the Oma bombing, Juliet Turner sang this song for the commemoration, I think, of that awful tragedy. And I remember listening to it at home on the radio and just bursting into tears. I think it was one of those songs that made me think of the power of song.
Well, we'll talk about that in a minute after we play this. Broken Things.
My heart.
Innie Kay is with me in studio tonight, picking all the tracks. That's a Juliet Turner song, Broken Things. And you just said before that, Ethna, that, you know, that songs like that make you realise how powerful songs can be. Is that always in your mind now when you're writing a song, that it actually you know, does it have to be powerful? I mean, some songs are powerful in other ways. They might just make you happy, and that's the end of it.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
That's power as well. You know,
it's not something that would be in my mind writing. No, I think it's just an effect that happens kind of with some degree of magic. I think somehow or other, some songs just really touch you. And that song just really, really touched me. And I thought, well, the power of it to bring a community that are grieving together was like, you know, really, really valuable and really, really special.
There are other songs that already exist, and they can acquire a whole new power in a different circumstance. Like, for instance, when Paul Simon sang The Sound of Silence at the 9/11 memorial.
Mm.
I mean, how often have we heard The Sound of Silence and know it's a great song? Everybody knows it's a great song. But when he sang it at that, it just became something else.
Yeah, isn't that funny?
So there is something weird about how songs can... They're never finished, you know,
they're totally alive. Yeah, there's a song I have called DNA, and I wrote it just with something else in mind altogether. Really just kind of, I was reading a book about Afghanistan, and just I was thinking, you know, how people can grow up in one area and have a completely different life to us here, and that kind of an idea. And then somebody wrote to me to see if they could use it for the abortion referendum, and how it, and then it was put to like pictures of how Irish women were treated over the decades, kind of a reading in the years sort of a thing. And I saw how the words really were apt for that, you know. So
it wasn't
funny.
Wasn't in your mind.
Not at all.
All,
but it just kind of changed the angle of the song altogether.
Songs are strange things, all right. Where do you think they come from?
Whoa.
do you have a theory on that?
Where do songs come from? I don't think I have a theory. I think there is something, there is a something indescribable really that happens when an idea or some, I suppose there's an impulse there of something that wants to be said really, as I suppose something that wants to be said, and then finding a way to put a shape on that.
Have you ever written a song where, you know, you've written it and you look at it and you go, I have no idea why I wrote that or where that... I'm using the phrase where it came from again, but in a different kind of a context where you look at it and you think, I have no idea how I wrote that, why I wrote that, even if I don't even remember writing it. The reason I ask is we had a poet a poet who said that poems have appeared on the page, and then there was this almost bewilderment afterwards as to where they'd...
I sort of love that, and I'd kind of love to have that experience, but I can't say I have. Mm. I seem to like really work out, just it mostly recently anyway, and the songs I'm working on at the moment seem to be something that I just feel the need to explore, like an idea or situation or something, and I just sort of work at it, like kind of, I don't know, sculpturing or just quite working away.
So
I know kind of where it comes from, and I've thought the things through quite a lot. So
I mean, some of the very best songs in the world were written by people who had had to write a song by 12 o'clock.
Quite
a lot of them. All the great songs, not all of them, but a lot of great songs were written in that manner, and that was done. And then give me a title for that one. Okay, well, next song.
Yeah, I was given a nice tip by a friend of mine. Patrick, who has a wonderful project called I Have a Tribe, and he was saying
it's a good record, that.
Super, yeah. And he was saying he was over at the People Festival over in Berlin, and he was playing with Feist, who is like one of my heroes. And I was going, what? And he was saying, yeah, I was playing Feist. And they had an exercise of where you'd pick any topic that you'd want to write about and just sing as if you'd written it 5 years ago, that it was already kind of written, already in existence. And I loved that. It was sort of like it takes you over the step of feeling like you still have to write it, like it's already done. And then apparently Patrick just played this song and it came out fully formed. So that kind of thing is pretty mysterious and pretty cool.
Okay, next choice. Oh, an old song actually, Dink's song. People associate it with Bob Dylan in particular, even though lots of other people have recorded it. What do you know about it?
I just know that Bob Dylan picked it up from a woman called Dink. I just love it. I heard it from a band called Furnace Mountain, who were playing on Shop Street in Galway many moons ago. I saw them there, and I just thought they were brilliant. I picked up their EP and listened to it loads and loads and loads, and sing the song quite a bit myself.
Dink's song. And that's Dink's Song, performed there by Furnace Mountain, the choice of Innie Kay, who's with me in studio. We're just talking there, Innie, Ethna, about, you know, the power of songs that you write. But what about the power of traditional songs like that that have been around for a long time? Because, they, you know, there's something about old songs.
Well-worn.
Yeah, and I mean, they're well-worn for a very good reason. You know, they must be significant or people would have forgotten them.
And when you think of all the people that have sung them and all the places and rooms they've been heard in, like, seem to take on an entity in themselves. Songs like that that you think have been sung and sung and sung.
I mean, that line, I know it's been attributed to Frank Hart and to other people as well, but, you know, that but you know, songs like that tell you how people felt. You know, history books tell you what happened.
That's right,
but these songs tell you what people felt. And another friend of mine, David Hammond, always used to say, you know, for a song to have survived for hundreds of years, there has to be something really powerful at the heart of it in order for people to keep it going. Otherwise, it would fall away. You know,
I think so, it's the nature of a good song if it keeps going. Like what's contained in that song, like for me that song, Wild Mountain Thyme, it's one of those I kind of almost feel a little embarrassed to sing because it's just so common and so so sung everywhere. But I often do it at gigs because it's just one that always, you just, when you get into that song and everyone is in it and they're singing Go Lassie Go, it's just, you can't deny, it's just like so well worn and people are in it and love it. And
everybody
for a
knows
reason.
It. Everybody
and
knows it.
And can share it, kind of enjoy it and share
and
it.
And yet that song's not that old. Because
it's not, it I guess,
written,
yeah.
I know there's an argument about this, but, you know, the claim is it was written by the McPeak family in Belfast.
Yeah, I've
so
heard that.
In which case it's not that old.
When were they? Like the
well, the family 50s, still goes, but which of the McPeaks would have been the probably the great-grandfather of the people who are alive at the moment, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Probably. They all, there was, it's complicated.
Yeah, and people say it's Scottish.
There was big Francie and young Francie and middle Francie and stuff like that. So I don't know which one it was.
Yeah, but then Elizabeth Cronin from Cork had a song called Bonnie Blue Eyed Lassie, and that's basically the same.
And people say it's Scottish, and Van Morrison has recorded it.
Yeah, and
Sandy Denny. Yeah. And Dylan's has sung that song as well. Yeah. So I don't know.
I like
the Belfast angle on it, though, that it might have been written in Belfast. But anyway, Rod Stewart recorded it as well, should you ever need it. Your next choice is Joanna Newsom.
Mm-hmm.
Another one of those kooky eccentrics in a wonderful way.
Yeah, and I think the first time I heard her, I wasn't sure. Like, I kind of loved it and kind of hated it all at once. The voice is so peculiar. But yeah, just the fact that it's so different and offers something completely new to my ears at the time, I loved it. So I think the first one I heard was Clam Cockle Cowrie.
That's a great song.
I loved that one. Yeah. Yeah, that was the first one I heard, and she just blew onto the scene like with something completely different.
I should apologise for reducing her to a kooky eccentric. It doesn't really cover it.
That and a lot more. I mean,
this is Joanna Newsom on a good day.
Hey.
Joanna Newsom there, and On a Good Day, the choice of Innie Kay. Mentioned Belfast earlier, and mentioned Van Morrison, and as it happens, your next choice is one of the big songs. Again. A song like Madam George, when you heard that for the first time, a bit like talking about Paul and Andy's or Andy Irvine's album, because if you talk to anybody who was around when this album came out, a lot of people were thrown by it, confused by it, blown away by it, couldn't figure it out, that kind of stuff. It's great when something like that comes along.
Yeah.
So what did you make of this version of Van Morrison when you heard it first?
I kind of when you say that, I kind of would have loved to have been there when it came out to see like what I would have thought.
Can you imagine bringing
that
home and putting it on and thinking, what's this?
Yeah. I think it was the first CD I bought actually, Astro Weeks. And I, Madam George especially, I think it's just a, like you can hear them in the room, you know, you can hear all the mistakes and, or not mistakes, just they're not mistakes at all. It's just, it's loose, you know, and gorgeously loose and imperfect, but so cool. and the string, I think the string section, when they come in and the whole thing kind of calms down and then gathers momentum again there towards the end. I just think it's fantastic. It's one of those ones just to turn on and have 10 minutes of bliss lying back on the bed or whatever, you know.
Madame George. Madame George, Madame Joy from Van Morrison, the choice of Innie Kay. Innie Kay. How are you doing, Anthony? All right?
I'm great. Love that. Yeah.
It changes the temperature of the room, that tune, doesn't it? Van, you know.
He's just cooled it all down.
Yeah, yeah, that's all right. We're nearly over. We're nearly there. Your next choice, I noticed, is Camille. Now, there are several Camilles. There's Camille O'Sullivan here, and there are a few others out there. But tell me about this Camille and the album. Is it La Fille,
yeah. I think it was Sean McErlane, a wonderful clarinet player, put me onto Camille. And I listened to it. I suppose I was doing a bit of looping and things and exploring my voice and stuff like that at the time. And Sean said, have a listen to this woman. And she goes all out, like, with kind of all sorts of sounds, vocal sounds. And yeah, pretty out there stuff sometimes. But this album I love because there's this gorgeous drone going the entire length of the album. And I think the feel means the thread. I could be wrong there, something like that. But there is a thread going through the entire thing, this drone. And yeah, I've listened to this album probably more than anything in the last while, partly due to my phone being not so great at holding much music at the moment, but I love this song. To me, it's sort of an old, it's got a real French feel to it. She is French. And funny enough, when I was over in Paris on a residency there last year for 6 weeks at the Centre Culturel Irlandais, I met via Adrian Crowley, who was also there. I met Camille's producer, who produced this record. Oh. So that was a real thrill because, you know, when you've listened to something so much, and he said that.
How was that residency, by the way? Because, you know, something we're talking about, Dingle being a distraction. Paris is a kind of a distraction.
Oh my God,
well.
Yeah. What a distraction. I think the idea that I'd actually make a record while I was over there was slightly optimistic. Mm. I think for anyone who, or for me, again, if I'm going on residency, I think the thing is just to take in the city or wherever you are. Take it in and too many distractions to actually make much work for me.
Did you have work in mind before you went there? Or were you hoping something would hit you in the course?
Both, really. I was starting to write this album I'm writing at the moment, and it's just taking longer. I thought I would have, you know, written more over there, but after a week or two, I realised that wasn't going to happen.
Paris. Put the books away. You're in Paris.
Go down and have a wine down in the local cafe.
And downstairs. You don't even have to go anywhere.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And there's Camille there, and that's the choice of Innie Kay, who's with me in studio. We're talking there about your residency in Paris, mm-hmm. Centre Culturel, and Rue des Irlandais. You get your own street and everything.
Yeah.
You mentioned Jeff Ballard. Did you worked with him? How did that come about? Now, Jeff Ballard is a serious drummer.
I know.
I'm not saying you shouldn't be playing with a serious drummer, but I mean, I can't just wonder how you met. Or...
Well, so it's just every now and then these kind of things happen that you go, well, how does that come together? And it's a wonderful thing. He was looking to do some duos, some collaborations in Dublin last year. And I was put together with him through the organiser, Matthew, who's running it, I think Note Productions, and put on a series of gigs in the Fumbly Stables there. And myself and another four or five musicians and poets were put together with Jeff. I think the most wonderful thing was flying back from Paris into Dublin and going to the Fumbly Stables and having like a 2-hour run through with Jeff, like a phenomenal jazz drummer. I play with a phenomenal drummer, Brian, in my band. So I love drums and percussion, but like Jeff would be a huge inspiration to Brian. So Brian was kind of going, wow, you know, and I got a CD from Brian of Jeff's music and listening away to it. So Jeff sent me one of his songs, which is called Come With Me, which is funny because I have a song called Come With Me as well. But so I learned this song that he had written, and he was playing away, and it was pure magic, like having this almost master class before the gig as we were sound checking and rehearsing. He's a terribly kind person, really, really lovely person to make music with, and was very, I thought, patient, because I'd have no jazz training, but I loved the challenge of making these phrases work in his song, and then in my own songs he was playing along with my songs, which was just an amazing experience. I felt incredibly grateful, and just that I was in this dream, really. And he was also playing along to a Shano song or two that I sang, and that was pretty awesome, just to hear this mix happening.
Wow. Mm. And then you went back to Paris?
And then I went back to Paris like 2 days later. No, I didn't, because a storm was on. So I had a week in Dublin going, I want to go back to Paris. I did eventually, but I was delayed. Yeah, but with that in my memory, it was lovely.
What are you like as a musician to work with? As a band leader? You talked about Jeff Ballard there being very patient and so on. A lot of band leaders, and I perfectly understand why, are not patient. And I understand why. It's their gig, it's their music, it's them. People are coming to see them, not the drummer, you know. What are you like?
I'm not sure how to answer this one. How can I find
out? Are you a hard taskmaster,
mistress? I wouldn't say I'm too hard. I'd say I like things to run smoothly. So things like just being places and time and stuff like that are important. But the lads I work with are fantastic, and they're both so talented, and just really, they're really great to work with.
Are you a perfectionist?
I would say I am, but I've managed to let go of a bit of that. That used to cause me awful trouble, because you get stressed out just being looking for perfectionism, you know, and then you just become a horrible person to make music with. There was once or twice where, just fights over small things before gigs, and like really rarely, once or twice. But I remember the difference on stage is awful. You know, you can't collaborate. You have to have a chat and make things are okay like beforehand. But that so rarely happens. But yeah, perfectionism can get in the way.
Especially because it doesn't exist anyway.
Yeah, exactly. So when you're trying to make something that doesn't exist, it's not going to help you. But more and more, I think just the little things, let them go, you know. And I think for a while I tried with perfectionism, when I'd listen back to things, they'd really irk me if I'd hear little imperfections. But now I just let them go more, you know.
What would be your idea of, you know, everything working out for you as a musician? Well, ideally, what would you want?
A good balance between playing and being at home would be really important.
Mm-hmm. Touring the world wouldn't appeal to you?
Not
constantly, anyway.
Extensively, yeah. No. I'm trying to work towards like picking out tours that I want to do that would be, you know, 2 weeks or so. More around Europe and not so far, you know, the odd tour in America. I'm going to Canada and America in February, so that'll be nice, but it'll be probably for a month, so that'll be quite long. But yeah, UK, Europe, and
in
being
terms
at home
of,
a lot.
And at home, you know, would you fancy having the best imaginable home studio, for instance? Or are you happy enough, you know, with
I'd love a home studio, like at the moment it's just bits and pieces in the sitting room, you know. I would love to have a place that you don't have to move things, you can go into and play. But yeah, I think like just to be around with friends and that is really important, and to have a sense of community and that you have a life where you are. I think if I'm travelling too much, it can be very disconcerting. Just to feel happy in that way.
Do you think that's a good thing, having a home studio? You know, some musicians are starting to think now that, well, you know, it was better when you hired a place for a fortnight and you went in and did it and that was it.
Mm.
You know, there's a lot of tinkering goes on when you've got your home studio, you know, fixing things and changing levels. And
I've never done it, so I don't really know. Only just on like GarageBand on my laptop. That's all. I'm trying to learn how to use Logic now, and do more on my own. But I think ideally I'd like to get it to a stage of where I know what's happening and all the arrangements at home, and then bring it to studio and have someone else help me with it, because I would be a little bit too... I'd find it hard to tell the wood from the trees sometimes when I'm in that area of needing to make a decision. But I'd like to do more of the process on my own and then bring it in, as opposed to going in and doing everything in the studio. Yeah.
Your next choice, and her name came up earlier on, Leslie Feist. You mentioned Feist, one of your pals was playing with her,
yeah.
Yeah. She's really, you know, I know with Broken Social Scene and all of that, but her own stuff is incredible, isn't it?
It really is, yeah. I just love what Vice does, and every album is kind of just that bit different, that she brings her audience along with her, like, and is unapologetic about what she does. I think I really like her integrity as a musician. Mm. And as a kind of really strong kind of... woman musician, I think it's just great to have her as a sort of a someone I look up to, I guess, you know. Just the way she does everything and the way she brings people in with her, like, she's got a good crowd around her, musicians, and she seems to galvanize a lot of people, you know. And yeah, I just love the sound of her new record, getting to hear it more now and get used to it. But this track is Get It Wrong, Get It Right from her album Metals.
Get It Wrong, Get It Right from Feist, the choice of Innie Kay, who's with me in studio. This has been great. So thanks a million for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
Enjoying
this great.
A lot. And you brought some great music in with you. Before you go, Ethna, there's a gig. I'm not sure if you've mentioned it or not. When is it? Where is it?
Yes, I have a gig in the Cobblestone on the 23rd of November with the full band. So it's Friday the 23rd of November. And then for Tradfest on the 24th of January, I'll be playing a double bill with David Kitt.
Oh, great. Okay. Yeah. You've been talking throughout this about you're working on a new record. So when is that likely to see the light of day?
Spring next year. Is what I'm thinking.
Up with the daffodils, eh?
Yeah, I love that time of the year to release an album. It's good. As long as it doesn't snow too much and you get kind of you can't get to gigs like what happened last year.
Oh, that's right. Yeah,
there's a lot of gigs planned for March and I couldn't make them. But it is a nice time of the year to bring out something new.
And I know you shouldn't and probably don't want to, but shouldn't talk about this record, but does it have it? Title or the songs anywhere nearly finished or what?
It's a good, I always feel like when there's six or seven songs in made or in somehow existing, then I feel like it's nearly, I'm on the other side, you know, I'm nearly towards 10. So there's a good half of it made, and I think the rest will come. I'm feeling like I'm in a good space to write at the moment. But I keep saying to people, I'm trying not to talk about it, because the more you talk about it, it's like you feel like you've done it. But like, you know, when you're in bed at night and you think you've gone to the toilet, you've just thought that you've gone to the toilet, but you haven't actually gone.
An interesting place to end the programme. But I think we all know what you're talking about.
You just do it rather than talk about it.
So your next... and then you fall asleep and you think you've got it. So your final choice is Esme Patterson. Tell me about this song.
Well, one of the wonderful things about working with a band like Brian Walsh, who's my drummer and percussionist, is I suppose he introduces me to a lot of music, and that's been a new chapter in my musical journey. So Brian introduced me to this woman. He'll often send stuff, have a listen to this. And he sent me this... recording. It's actually from NPR Tiny Desk Concerts, and it's just so hot. The live recording, this what we're going to hear, is so hot and groovy. There we go.
Thank
again
you.
And like the groovy, and funny enough, I think it's so much better than her commercial recording, so that's why I chose this one. But electric guitar and voice and really gorgeous drums and bass. Wait till you hear the bass in it. So Esme Patterson, No River.
Ethna, N.E.K., thanks a million.
Thanks a million, John.
You've been listening to a podcast of Mystery Train with John Kelly. Mystery Train hits the rails every Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on 96 to 99 RTE Lyric FM.